When you're in traffic these days, four-wheel drives are everywhere. Most of them are registered in the cities and rarely leave the bitumen. They can be deadly urban assault vehicles. Many of them guzzle fuel at a rate that makes the big Falcons and Commodores look like petrol misers. And the toxic emissions that many four-wheel drives spew from their exhaust pipes can rate up there with small trucks. Four-wheel drive sales have boomed over the past decade. They now make up about a quarter of all new passenger vehicle sales in this country. In contrast, regulation by federal and state governments is going at a snail's pace. It's been a similar situation in the United States, where four-wheel drives now rule the roads. New Australian safety research you'll hear about on today's program adds to the concern. Welcome to Background Briefing on ABC Radio National. I'm Stephen Skinner. At the Monash University Accident Research Centre in Melbourne, Professor Brian Fylde spends all day studying crashes. The centre has been worried about four-wheel drive safety for a long time. And that's why he's alarmed by the huge popularity of four-wheel drives. Actually, here they're now officially called sports utility vehicles, or SUVs, as they're called in America.
In the US, these vehicles, SUVs, are running at about 50% of all sales, so they've got a real problem over there. But we're catching up, and catching up far too fast. I mean, I have no problems with a four-wheel drive being used for the purpose that it's designed for, which is really off-road use. But from my observations and from some studies that have been carried out by automobile clubs and so on, a high proportion of these vehicles never leave the sealed surface. And you see people using them for business, for delivering kids to school and so on. And you've got to question why they need such a big, aggressive vehicle as a four-wheel drive, driving around in a population of passenger cars, when they are potentially harmful, 2 to 3 times likely to cause death or serious injury in the event that they collide with a passenger car, and that varies depending on the size of the car that they're involved in a crash with. So, I mean, they are potentially very dangerous vehicles.
The Monash Accident Research Centre is so concerned about four-wheel drives that it's been urging governments to try and limit their use to people with a fair dinkum need for them, such as farmers, miners and emergency service personnel. The centre has urged the federal government to end the 10% price advantage that imported four-wheel drives enjoy. Brian Fylde says the centre has also been lobbying state governments about four-wheel drives.
One of the arguments that we've been running lately is that if they are likely to cause more harm in a crash to the other occupants of the vehicles that they hit, then they should have a greater burden of the cost of compensation for injury rehabilitation. So another way you could do it is to actually increase their insurance premiums to a level that would compensate for the amount of damage they're causing.
New research by the Monash Accident Research Centre suggests that four-wheel drives are going to figure much more prominently in road carnage in the years to come. Not only is the proportion of four-wheel drives in the vehicle fleet increasing, but the proportion of side impact crashes in Australia is increasing as well. And this is a fatal combination because side impacts are the most dangerous type. There's far less metal to protect the driver. Higher four-wheel drives hit at window level anyway, although some have two-stage bumper bars which make an initial impact lower down. Figures for Victoria show that while the number of deaths from frontal impacts has gone down in the past 15 years, deaths from side impacts haven't. In Victoria, about 150 people a year are killed from side impacts, mostly from head injuries. Brian Fylde says the same trend would apply throughout Australia.
I guess we're making some inroads into protecting people in head-on crashes, and some of that's the effectiveness of airbags, and some of it's slower speeds and a few other things, and better highways, I guess, more separation. But we're not having the same impact on side impact crashes, and I think a lot of that's to do with what seems to be an increase in red light running at intersections, because about 60 to 65% of all side impacts occur at intersections. And so that's of great concern to us, has been for some time now.
Professor Fylde says there's no evidence that four-wheel drives are more likely than sedans to run red lights or career through intersections. But when they do, the effects are more devastating. and the damage is especially bad if the four-wheel drive brandishes that common fashion accessory at the front, a bull bar.
When a four-wheel drive's involved in a side impact collision with a normal passenger car, and you can test this for yourself when you're out driving next to one of these devices, have a look at where the top of the bull bar is. It's roughly in line with your head. And so, you know, if you get hit by one of these things on the side of the vehicle, is it in a T-bone type crash, then, you know, you run a very high risk of these devices causing serious injuries or death.
That T-boning that Professor Fildes just referred to was also graphically described by his Monash colleague Professor Raphael Grizzibeta on ABC TV's Catalyst program last year.
This time when the occupant was coming out the window, the head struck the bull nose and you could actually see the dent in the actual bonnet.
When hit side-on by a four-wheel drive, you are 26 times more likely to be seriously injured or killed.
The horrific effect of being hit side-on by a big SUV was shown on a recent episode of the Ten Network drama The Guardian.
And it's not like me usually, I just leave these things up to fate.
The stars of the show, Nick, played by Australian actor Simon Baker, and Lulu, were driving along in their medium-sized sedan when a distracted mother turning around to her young son in the back of a giant SUV plowed straight through an intersection and into the young couple. A major reason four-wheel drives are so popular is that their owners feel safer than in a normal car, and they are safer if they hit a vehicle smaller than themselves. Four-wheel drivers are higher up too, so they get a better view of the road ahead. But four-wheel drives can actually be more dangerous for their occupants too. Some larger four-wheel drives are built on a stiff chassis, which doesn't have a sedan's ability to crumple and therefore absorb the impact of a major collision. Even if the four-wheel drive does have good crumple zones, these can be neutered if there's a big steel bull bar on the front. Perhaps the main danger for occupants of taller four-wheel drives is a rollover, where they can be crushed by the roof or have their heads slammed through the windows onto the road. In the US last year, a staggering 5,000 people died in SUV rollovers. Brian Fildes.
Because of their high centre of gravity, they have a much higher propensity to roll over if they're either driven carelessly or if they're involved in a collision. From some data that we analysed a few years ago, we showed about a four times higher propensity to roll over for a four-wheel drive that's involved in a collision than a passenger car. So while they potentially seem to be quite safe, they are nevertheless not the perfect solution.
Professor Brian Fildes, head of industry research for Australia's largest car insurer, the IAG Group, is Robert McDonald. He thinks safety experts are getting a little carried away, grouping all four-wheel drives together in the one dangerous category for both side impact and rollover. On the phone, Robert McDonald.
My only concern is that sometimes people get hung up on this description of four-wheel drives when they really mean the large two-ton fully framed four-wheel drives in effect, and they're sort of lumping in a lot of smaller, quite relatively benign passenger vehicles in with that, and these are the more common mid-sized so-called four-wheel drives or sport utility vehicles like the Subarus and the Honda CRVs and that sort of thing, which I don't think is the intention, but I don't like them being lumped, everything being lumped in the one basket as a four-wheel drive.
Robert McDonald says there would be practical difficulties in singling out four-wheel drives for higher compulsory third-party personal injury premiums.
Well, one of the problems with CTP insurance in Australia is to get useful data out of the system is quite difficult in terms of injuries and that sort of thing and to what type of injuries. And also there's limitations, I believe, on the degree with which variations can be made in premium based on particular makes and models of cars in particular. So there's not the freedom that we might have in terms of comprehensive insurance.
Robert McDonald from Insurance Australia Group. You're listening to a story about four-wheel drives on ABC Radio National's Background Briefing. senior policy advisor with Australia's largest motoring club, the NRMA, is Jack Haley. I asked him why four-wheel drives are so popular with motorists who realistically aren't going to use the four-wheel drive capability.
There's a range of responses when you ask that question. Some people like the high seating position, which they say gives them better vision over traffic that they're following, but then again, the more of these things that are around, the less that becomes an advantage. Some people feel safer in something bigger and heavier, but the crash statistics that we analyse show that they're about the same as a large car in that respect. Some people note the greater number of seating positions. You can get up to 7 in a four-wheel drive wagon, which is certainly better than most cars and even better than some vans, passenger vans. And, of course, there's still that romantic notion that one day we're all going to drive around Australia and we need a four-wheel drive to do it in.
But most people, in fact, never get to drive around Australia.
The statistics would suggest that's right. Certainly the manufacturers' surveys that I'm aware of show that's the case.
Jack Haley from the NRMA. Keith Bradshaw is a former Detroit bureau chief for the New York Times. He's written a book on sports utility vehicles called High and Mighty, which has caused quite a stir in the US. Here's an extract from the book.
Who's been buying SUVs since automakers turned them into family vehicles? They tend to be people who are insecure and vain. They are frequently nervous about their marriages and uncomfortable about parenthood. They often lack confidence in their driving skills. Above all, they're apt to be self-centered and self-absorbed, with little interest in their neighbours or communities. No, that's not a cynic talking. That's the auto industry's own market researchers and executives.
A reading from the American book High and Mighty.
I'll get these out of the way so no one runs over them.
In a car park, which could be in any city or suburb, I spoke to four-wheel drive owners about their vehicles. These two motorists pulled up in their turbo-diesel Toyota Land Cruiser.
Yes. Do you mind if I ask one of you a bit about your Land Cruiser?
That's all right, how exciting. Walk away.
All right.
That's when you come out, Daddy, come on down.
This is our family car. We've had our Land Cruiser for 3 years. Before this one, we had another Land Cruiser for 5 years. We think it's the best car we've ever owned.
It's awfully big and it can get through anything.
Yes.
Terrible to park, but... because I'm so small, like,
that is true.
I can't see the four corners of the car, so if you hit something, you hit something.
And when you say you can get through what?
Oh, everything, Tay. Everybody's scared of a Land Cruiser.
We like it because it's a lot higher than most other cars in traffic, which enables my mother, who is a short person, to see above the traffic. So, yeah, she really likes that about the Land Cruiser, that she can be above everyone else. Also, we've had an accident in our previous Land Cruiser, and it was a lot safer to be in the Land Cruiser than a normal car.
That's becoming an increasing concern with them. It's not only safety for other smaller vehicles that they hit, or pedestrians, but safety for the occupants, because they've got a higher centre of gravity, mm-hmm. and now the studies seem to be showing they've got a higher chance of rollover.
Did they?
You didn't know that?
I didn't know that, no. Don't know much about cars. I love my Land Cruiser. I also like it, the bull bars that they used to have on them. I thought they were really good. They were really good in an accident. That was, well, when we had the front on accident, we had a bull bar on the front. And it did a lot more damage to the other car, but it was their fault, so.
In the same car park, a woman was packing groceries into the back of her V8 Range Rover, which she uses mainly to do the shopping and ferry the children around.
I've had about 6 Range Rovers and for over about 7, 8, 9, 10 years, so no, I love them.
What about the four-wheel drive mode? Do you get into the bush at all?
We do, not a lot, but look, when the odd time when we do go to the Southern Highlands or something like that, it's there when we want to use it, but it's not the reason why I have a four-wheel drive.
And what about towing? You don't normally tow?
No, I don't tow, no. I just feel very safe in a four-wheel drive. I like being high up, and I feel it's a car that it's not too precious, so I feel I haven't got to sort of really look after it, sort of, you know, kids, dogs, I have 2 dogs, and shopping, and it's just practical.
Now, speaking of being high up, that's a safety problem with them. They're at higher risk of rollover, all of these larger four-wheel drives. Does that worry you?
Well, no, I don't. It depends how you drive them, I think. I mean, they are different to drive, but I think once you know how to drive them, they're safe.
What about other motorists and pedestrians? Are you concerned that you're in such a big vehicle and, you know, the damage that that could do if you hit somebody else?
No, I mean, it's a two-way thing. I don't even think about hitting anybody. I mean, if they hit me, that's their problem. But, no, I feel I'm probably safer being in a four-wheel drive.
Every second four-wheel drive in the car park had a bull bar. And it's no wonder when bull bars are actually being given away.
What's the bottom line on Nissan's end of financial year sale? You can get a patrol wagon with an awesome 185 kilowatt petrol or powerful intercooled turbo diesel engine. And free bull bar, driving lights and tow bar. That's over $2,100 of extra value. While all Navara 4x4s come with air conditioning and a free bull bar. But the bottom line is, it can't last for long.
In the car park, this man admitted he didn't need the bull bar stuck to the front of his Land Cruiser.
I think that is just to make the car look better. I don't really think that I need the bull bar. Just to make the car look more, I don't know what, make it look better.
This man, however, regularly tows a horse float to the country in his Mitsubishi Pajero.
I know it's a bone of contention here with these bull bars, but believe me, I probably agree with people here in the city.
Agree with what?
It can be a danger down here for some of the people driving them, but there's equally enough of bad drivers, there's equally enough bad pedestrians, unfortunately, and school kids. But for me, and the safety of my kids, we had cattle, probably somewhere 300-400 doing a stock route run there between Gunnedah and Coonabarabin the other day. All out of the blue, just came around a corner. Here they are, 300-400 everywhere. Didn't need the bull bar, but I did later in the evening with kangaroos. So if I hit one, if I see one, I'm not stopping. I go right over it, and it's going to help my kids and help my car and the horses, last but not least.
Now, with bull bars around the city, if that's all they're doing, you know, they are particularly dangerous. Just look at this car park.
Yep. Yes, totally agree with you. But where do you draw the line? What's the fine line? The mums in here, I know they've probably got the safety of their kids at heart, picking them up from school, but they're not warranted. But how can I put them on and put them off every 4 weeks or 6 weeks? If someone can come up with a happy medium or a happy answer, I think it solves a lot of questions. Answers a lot of questions, but how you actually, without banning them totally down here, so hope it helps you.
Thanks very much, mate.
Most four-wheel drive models are far more polluting than normal sedans. Some are sold with emissions reduction catalysts, but these aren't compulsory. So it's no surprise that in a report last year, the Federal Transport Department concluded the following.
Recent testing indicates that emissions from four-wheel drives are significantly higher than emissions from passenger cars, and can be 8 to 15 times higher if catalysts are not used.
The Transport Department report goes on to say that even under new emission standards to come into force in 2005, four-wheel drives will still be allowed to be 50% worse than normal cars.
Hi, what would you like?
Fill her up, thanks.
The bigger four-wheel drives are extremely heavy on fuel. In city driving, the biggest ones can burn through almost twice the fuel of a Commodore or a Falcon. It's hard, though, to get exact fuel consumption figures for them. Take the very popular Toyota Land Cruiser. We tried in vain to check its fuel use on the Toyota Australia website, the Greenhouse Office Fuel Consumption Guide, and in the spec sheets listed in car and four-wheel drive magazines. But according to British figures, the V8 Land Cruiser uses a whopping 21 litres per 100 kilometres in city driving. Jack Haley from the NRMA says relatively cheap petrol helps explain the rise of four-wheel drives in both the US and Australia.
I think we're seeing the same effect here as has driven the US situation. I think in terms of fuel price, we're between the US and Europe. And Europe is really an area, a collection of countries that are basically have small cars. I mean, the large cars such as the E&S class Mercedes and so on are quite rare. They're maybe 10 or 15% of the total population in Europe, whereas the rest of the car fleet is quite small because they've had high fuel prices for decades, and that's driven them towards low fuel consumption vehicles. In the US, the opposite prevailed. Of course, they've had low fuel prices for decades, and that's meant that large vehicles are economically feasible and have become popular. I think we're halfway between. We've got a fuel price which is halfway between, and we've got a vehicle fleet which is halfway between. So I think the fuel price drives vehicle size more than anything else.
As Jack Ailey points out, we haven't got as high a proportion of the huge SUVs on our roads as in the United States. But even our so-called light four-wheel drives can weigh nearly as much as a Falcon or Commodore and use more fuel. Take the Ford Escape.
When I'm not on the Today Show reporting the weather, I like to create it.
Hurtling along a beach in this ad with Nine Network weather girl Semi Lucas behind the wheel.
You name it, my Ford Escape four-wheel drive gives me the power to do it. And right now it also gives you the power to win one of four...
The Ford Escape officially uses 13 litres of fuel per 100 k's in city driving, compared with 11.5 litres for the Ford Falcon. Next year, Ford plans to release a hybrid petrol-electric version of the Escape, which will use a lot less fuel. In April, the federal government announced a voluntary fuel economy target for sedans, which the industry has agreed to reach by 2010. But we'll have to wait at least another year to find out what the fuel economy target will be for four-wheel drives. Opposition Environment spokesman Kelvin Thompson points out that we've heard it all before.
Back in November 1997, the Howard government said it would extend fuel consumption targets to include, for the first time, light commercial vehicles and four-wheel drives. What in fact has occurred since then is nothing. The government has been sitting on its hands, and we now find, just in the last few weeks, that it's announced the same thing again. That is that it will find fuel consumption targets to include, for the first time, four-wheel drives and light commercial vehicles. So the fact that they can put out two press releases with identical content about 6 years apart tells us that they have been sitting on their hands. They haven't been taking the action that needed to be taken.
Shadow Environment Minister Kelvin Thompson. Jack Haley from the NRMA says there's no excuse for such lenient treatment of four-wheel drives on fuel economy targets.
The NRMA view is that all passenger vehicles, which we include four-wheel drives in that, should be included in any national average fuel consumption target, because there's so many of them. They're obviously passenger vehicles. They've got all the luxury features of passenger vehicles. They've got, you know, leather seats, CD players, air conditioning. They're advertised as passenger cars. So they should be included in that target. It's really an anomaly dating from many, many years ago. In the early days, they were utilitarian vehicles that were really aimed at farmers and commercial users and were genuinely off-road vehicles. Whereas these days, most of them are not used off-road for any significant time at all.
So have you got any hard stats on that?
No, we don't have any specific statistics, but there are many manufacturers' own surveys which show that only a small proportion of their vehicles go seriously off-road, and that's typically, in the ones I've seen, is 10 to 20%.
What about towing, though? Are they any better than a big Falcon or Commodore for towing?
The very largest ones would be marginally better, because obviously the more weight you've got in front of the towing vehicle, or what's being towed, inherently the more stable it will be. But the Falcon and Commodore are rated up to, in some cases, over 2 tonnes for towing. So there's really not much outside that which, you know, the average driver would need to tow, I would think.
Jack Haley, Senior Policy Advisor with the NRMA Motoring Club.
So that you can understand how that theory is applied to some real problems in fluid mechanics.
In a Department of Mechanical Engineering lab at Melbourne University, Professor Harry Watson shows me the little engine which determines the octane rating of fuels.
Well, this is the engine that's used for doing octane rating. Different fuels at the pump are sold with different octane numbers. This is running without any abnormal combustion.
Professor Watson is president of the Society of Automotive Engineers, and he wrote a report for the federal government on fuel economy in sedans. After the first of the oil shocks in the 1970s, the US government set fuel economy standards for sedans, which helped get many Americans out of their big yank tanks and into smaller cars. Average fuel efficiency in sedans doubled by the late 80s. But Professor Watson says these fuel economy gains have been cancelled out by the rise of the petrol-guzzling SUVs.
There has been a very significant move to the sports utility vehicles, which are classified in the US under light trucks, and that has resulted in although the fuel consumption reduced in the way that I mentioned, there has been a significant increase in the number of people using these heavier vehicles, and so the net impact in the US market has been almost zero over the last 10 years or so because of the increased movement of people in that direction. Maybe we're seeing a move like that taking place in Australia, so somehow there has to be some pressure to bear on the providers of these vehicles to take on the same sort of philosophy that's being taken on for the passenger cars. And, you know, if they're not in the equation at the moment, then they certainly need to get in there in the future, because it's very easy to build these 2.5-ton vehicles that have no concept of fuel efficiency at all.
Professor Harry Watson. The ongoing saga of the humble windscreen sticker displaying a new vehicle's fuel use began over a decade ago with the Labor government. The fuel consumption stickers were finally mandated for sedans and the smaller four-wheel drives 2 years ago. They're a label about 10 centimetres square, showing how many litres per 100 k's the vehicle gets in city driving. The biggest four-wheel drives were supposed to have the stickers by January this year, but that target has blown out again to January next year. Lachlan McIntosh is Chief Executive of the Australian Automobile Association, which represents the state motoring clubs like the NRMA, RACV and the RACWA. He says the resistance to the stickers from the auto industry is typical of what he calls its head-in-the-sand attitude on safety and the environment.
You'd often have to wonder why that should be so difficult. Manufacturers are more than happy to report power output or torque figures, but find it very difficult to report straightforward fuel efficiency. It seems to me that there's no reason that shouldn't be in the handbook or stuck on the window of the car. The government does test and makes a comparison available. That comparison's what's really important for people to understand, but it seems to me it's not difficult to put a reasonable sort of piece of information on the vehicle that's sold. And not only for new cars, but for used cars as well. I think there's no real reason why we shouldn't. The used car dealer has to put a lot of other information on about how far the car's been driven, what the odometer reading is, and who the owner previously may or may not have been. It's not difficult for them to have to also say, well, this car had, when it was new, a specific fuel efficiency, and perhaps also a used car safety rating. I think they're important pieces of information. They're somewhat difficult for the ordinary punter to find at the moment. They're available through the motoring clubs or the state government agencies, but it's better if all that information was available on the car when they bought it.
Lachlan McIntosh from the Automobile Association of Australia. Dr. Brian Robinson is the Melbourne-based chairman of a voluntary national organisation called Greenfleet. For $30 a year, Greenfleet will plant 17 trees for you in the country. That's the number of trees it takes to soak up the average car's annual emissions of carbon dioxide. The biggest four-wheel drives would need 30 trees. Dr. Robinson was chairman of the Victorian Environment Protection Authority for 16 years until he retired last year. He says it's not just the federal government which has the power to do something about fuel economy, or the lack of it, in four-wheel drives. In a small park near Collins Street, he says state governments could act as well.
Certainly, I think there's a very good case to be made out that there should be a differential based on engine capacity, fuel efficiency, and weight of the vehicle. What we're seeing is a fashion shift from the standard passenger car to, you know, 2.5, 3-ton, four-wheel drive, essentially commercial vehicles in their original concept, small trucks, if you like, that have now been dressed up to make them more acceptable to the passenger market. There's very little reason for these cars to be given any kind of favourable treatment. In fact, the opposite is the case. They do present safety problems in the roads, but more particularly, when you have a strong push for the vehicle passenger fleet to improve its overall fuel efficiency, there's no point in letting this be offset by these semi-commercial vehicles becoming, in effect, the passenger vehicle of choice with much higher fuel consumptions.
Dr. Brian Robinson from Greenfleet. Radio National's background briefing visited the giant Ford plant at Broadmeadows on the Hume Highway in Melbourne's north. This week is the 100th birthday of the Ford Motor Company. In recent years, the parent Ford company in the US has taken over or taken major shares in other big brands including Volvo, Mazda, Jaguar and Land Rover, so that now Ford is the biggest manufacturer of four-wheel drives in the world. Ford doesn't make four-wheel drives in Australia, yet anyway. But next year, a new Australian-designed vehicle called the Territory will roll off these assembly lines.
This is called the final assembly line, where virtually the last stages of the assembly process are done before they go into the test rolls area.
What have we got?
Oh, lots of people backed up outside.
Who's there?
In his office overlooking the Hume Highway is Ford Australia President Jeff Politis. Mr. Politis is an affable man, an economics graduate and sales expert who's been with the company on and off for more than 30 years. He's also the new chairman of the peak body for the car industry in Australia, the Federal Chamber of Automotive Industries, or FCAI. Jeff Politis is enthusiastic about the new Ford Territory model.
We've shown it at the Melbourne Motor Show, and it looks a bit like nothing else, in as much as it's neither a Falcon, it's neither a station wagon, and it's not a big SUV four-wheel drive. It's something that sits in between, and it represents the next, what we think is the next generation of vehicle for the customers who want some of the attributes of four-wheel drives, but not all of them. And you made the point earlier about they buy four-wheel drives, but they never go off-road. Territory will have sedan ride qualities, which is one of the compromises that you do get when you buy a four-wheel drive. You lose the good sedan ride and the handling. Territory will have those, but it will also have the capacity to do off-road work. It will have the capacity to carry up to 7 people, which is one of the reasons why people buy four-wheel drives. They don't actually want the big rugged thing, but they want to be able to carry more than 5 people, so Territory will do that.
The new Ford Territory is likely to be safer than the usual four-wheel drives because it will actually be all-wheel drive. In other words, all 4 wheels will drive the car all the time. This gives good traction on bitumen. And the Territory will be lower than the bigger 4-wheel drives, so it should be less prone to rollovers. Jeff Politis sees little cause for concern on 4-wheel drive safety in general.
They are all tested to meet the Australian design rules. Every vehicle that's sold here meets the Australian design rules, which have been set up by the authorities to guarantee a minimum level of safety.
But there's no Australian design rule on propensity for four-wheel drives to roll over or their crashworthiness when they do roll over, for instance.
I'm not sure of what the rollover requirements are. I know as a company, Ford has its own internal standards and whatever we do will meet those. And I can only really talk with my Ford hat on there.
In the year 2000, Ford in the US pledged to cut fuel use in its SUVs by 25% by 2005. The company recently reneged on that pledge. Nevertheless, Jeff Politis says he's confident four-wheel drive fuel consumption will improve a lot in coming years.
You can get the so-called common rail direct-injected diesel engines in some of the big four-wheel drives coming in, which are extremely fuel-efficient and extremely good on greenhouse gas. Very expensive because of the technology they involve, and to be a benefit they require low sulphur fuel, which we as a country don't have yet. We're moving towards it, but we're not there yet and won't be for a couple of years. When that happens, then you'll be able to buy a large four-wheel drive which will be extremely fuel efficient and extremely good in terms of its greenhouse gases.
Jeff Politis, President of Ford Australia and Chairman of the Federal Chamber of Automotive Industries. The Australian car-making industry directly employs about 50,000 people, which gives it a lot of clout with politicians. Politicians are also sensitive to the voting power of four-wheel drive owners. Long gone are the days when four-wheel drive owners were mainly farmers, miners or other bushies. In the early 70s, farmers were given a favour by having the tariff rate on four-wheel drive slashed compared with the tariff rate for imported sedans. No one foresaw then that the four-wheel drive would become a luxury urban tank. In the 1998 election campaign, Labor pledged to end the tariff advantage for what Simon Crean disparagingly called two-rack tractors. This would have added thousands of dollars to the price of four-wheel drives. Prime Minister John Howard seized on the issue, and here he is on Melbourne commercial radio at the time.
That was a pure piece of old-fashioned class sneering. I mean, what Simon Crean was endeavouring to do with that sneering comment was to imply that every Australian who's got a four-wheel drive is some kind of rich aristocrat. Now, we don't want that in this country. We don't want that kind of old-fashioned class envy. There are lots of people with modest middle aspirations who have four-wheel drives. I don't. I'm not carrying a flag for four-wheel drives, but I am carrying a flag against class envy. I think it is alien to what Australia is all about. I mean, we are all about people being encouraged to get ahead, not about trying to carve us up into little class-tagged groups. And that is basically what Simon Crean and Kim Beazley are doing.
Labor dumped its four-wheel drive policy after the election. Shadow Environment spokesman Kelvin Thompson.
Well, there was a lack of public support for it. It was an issue of some contest during the 1998 federal election.
So it actually had some bearing on the overall outcome, you think?
Oh, well, it's always difficult to know exactly why people vote for certain measures and not for certain other measures, but it was an issue that was raised and campaigned on during the course of the federal election campaign. There's no doubt in my mind that it was a campaign issue.
Kelvin Thompson. Background Briefing requested interviews with Environment Minister David Kemp and Parliamentary Transport Secretary Ron Boswell, but their press secretaries said they are unavailable. Our fascination with size, power and speed shows little sign of abating. We've even seen the return of the legendary V8 muscle cars of 30 years ago, the Holden Monaro and the Ford Falcon GT. In its heyday, the Falcon GT was reckoned to be the fastest four-door sedan in the world. Here's an old clip of the Falcon GTHO, better known as just the Ho, preparing for the Bathurst 500 in 1971.
Company, the Ford Falcon GTHO.
This year, Ford Works Team is again favoured for prestige outright honours. The most powerful car in the race, the GTHO Falcon, with an undisclosed output of between 300 and 400 brake horsepower.
Hans Tholstrup is well known for his fuel economy drives around Australia. But 30 years ago, he used to race the famous Falcon GTHO, as he describes on the line from Denmark.
When you sat in the hole and the throbbing of the V8 and at the starting grid, your right leg and everything on your right side of your body was trembling, and then the flag dropped and the hole just shivered and took off, and you were going up the mountain and just going around and around, and having come from a Datsun 1600 into the big V8 Ho, it was just pure adrenaline pushing and just pure magic.
So you enjoyed it?
Oh, absolutely. I can't deny that. And I wouldn't deny that I would enjoy jumping into one of the world's best cars today and go around a racetrack. I mean, it's in the breeding of the man and in the beast. And, of course, that's why the beast is sold today. And even though the environment can't handle it, the beast is still in us.
On board with the Enforcer, he's still moving, which is always a good sign, but he's fourth at the moment.
Big, fast, noisy cars are a symbol of sex and power just as much today as they were 30 years ago. Take this extract from a recent edition of Wheels magazine, which refers to horny beasts.
The engines play central roles in these cars' characters. Although the Ford's rev limit isn't quite as high as the Holden's, it generally feels more responsive when you get on the gas, and certainly sounds the more evocative as its throaty V8 wail fills the cabin and pours from the pipes to send a deliciously fierce shimmer through everything nearby.
Four-wheel drives are no exception when it comes to a thirst for V8 power. Jeep, Land Rover, BMW, Mercedes, Lexus and Toyota all have big V8 models. At the opposite end of the scale to the Toyota Land Cruiser is the Toyota Prius. The Prius is about the size of a Toyota Corolla, but it has a hybrid petrol and electric engine system, which means it uses less than a quarter of the fuel of a Land Cruiser around town. The Prius's number one fan is Democrats Transport and Energy spokeswoman Lynn Allison, who took me for a spin near her office in Melbourne.
there are various combinations of the petrol engine working, the electric motor working, and the battery feeding electricity to progress the car. So as a result of that, it gets by with a very small motor because it's got other elements working to drive you along.
So is the engine actually on at the moment, or is it running just on the battery?
Well, the engine's not running at present. The electric motor is running, and that's driving it. When I accelerate, and I'll do that now, you can see that the petrol motor starts to come in, and we get arrows coming from the petrol engine showing it driving the wheels and showing it feeding electricity back into the battery. So I'm just braking now, and it shows the arrows go towards the battery, meaning it's feeding electricity back into the battery.
Watch out for that van.
Well, in braking for that van, of course, we've charged the battery in some small way.
Democrat Senator Lynn Allison. Environment Minister David Kemp also has a Prius which he uses on official business. The problem with small sedans like this is they're more dangerous for the people inside them than big sedans. There's a real dilemma on Australia's roads about saving fuel but wasting lives, especially when there are so many big four-wheel drives lurking around. The experts call this problem vehicle incompatibility. Professor Brian Fields again.
It's essentially pure physics. The heavier the car, the lower the crash severity. Let me give you an example. If two cars, one say 800 kilograms, one 1600 kilograms, were to run into each other, both travelling at the same speed, the crash severity on the lighter car will be twice that of the crash severity of the bigger car. Therefore, higher crash severity means higher likelihood of being seriously injured for the occupants in that vehicle. So, you know, physics tells us that the safer car is always the heavier one within a car context. Now, you know, you can argue that a four-wheel drive's heavier again and therefore should be more safe, but it's not, because there's a total change of structure going from a standard passenger car configuration to a four-wheel drive configuration.
Professor Brian Fields from the Monash University Accident Research Centre. He says people mover vans are a much better option for families than four-wheel drives because they're at least as safe as large sedans.
Buildings in Washington now evacuated the White House, the Pentagon. We have a report that there has been a collapse at part of the Pentagon itself. There was
recent world events have seen SUVs come under fire in the United States for their dependence on oil imported from the Middle East. This ad by an anti-SUV lobby group accused SUV owners of being unpatriotic.
This is George. This is the gas that George bought for his SUV. This is the oil company executive who sold the gas that George bought for his SUV. These are the countries where the executive bought the oil that made the gas that George bought for his SUV. And these are the terrorists who get money from those countries every time George fills up his SUV.
While on a military theme, it's the US Defence Force which could ultimately drive a reduction in SUV fuel guzzling using Australian technology. Late last year, a US military plane landed at the Richmond Air Force Base on the outskirts of Sydney. On board the plane was a small six-wheel drive army truck. The truck was then sent to Ballina on the New South Wales North Coast for tests at the home of a new Australian technology called PermaDrive. The nitrogen-based PermaDrive pump is bolted underneath the chassis of a large vehicle. It stores energy released when the vehicle brakes and then releases that energy when the vehicle wants to accelerate. It can save 30% in fuel. The US Army has been so impressed that last month it signed a deal with PermaDrive, which the company expects to be the first step on the road to mass production. Near the Sydney offices of financial backer Deutsche Bank, PermaDrive Chief Executive Max Bisotti said the US military wants to reduce its massive fuel use by 75% by 2010.
fuel is a very important aspect of their operations in any sort of operating theatre. The US Army has a number of vehicles that do sort of, you know, gallons to the mile as opposed to miles to the gallon.
And apparently it was costing them up to $600 US a gallon just to supply fuel to the forces in Iraq.
Yeah, it's what's called a ripple effect. It's the whole cost of, you know, getting fuel into that battle zone when you add up all the costs of those, the transport, the personnel involved, you know, the additional equipment. That sort of opportunity cost is that it, that can be that high. So it's very important for them to reduce that. In recent other, you know, major conflagrations like the Second World War, there was this classic case of Patton in his advance with his tanks through Europe, that he had to halt and just wait for the fuel to catch up with him. I understand this was also the case in Iraq, where the US Army had to sort of momentarily pause and wait for the fuel to catch up. So fuel is a very important aspect of any engagement. If you look at the first Gulf War, and they looked at the amount of money that was expended during that campaign, the highest component of that was in fact fuel.
Max Bisotti. Permo Drive financial chief Greg Beaver says the technology could easily be applied to SUVs.
And in the US, where basically they've predicted that the entire consumption, or the increase in the consumption of fuel over the next 20 years, will be taken up by trucks and four-wheel drives and the big sports utility vehicles. There is a race on to find technologies that will be applicable so they can keep the Yanks, the Americans can keep driving their big SUVs. So, yeah, one day it will definitely be applicable to those SUVs and four-wheel drives, and I think the Army will probably lead the way there as well.
Greg Beaver from Permadrive. Author Keith Bradshaw says something has to be done about SUVs and not just on fuel economy. Here's another extract from his book High and Mighty.
SUVs are terrible substitutes for cars, but badly designed government regulations, often shaped by industry lobbyists, have created huge incentives for automakers to build ever-growing numbers of SUVs anyway. The manufacturers have beguiled Americans into buying SUVs with lavish and sometimes misleading advertising campaigns, and by coming up with vehicle designs that appeal to the darkest shadows of human nature. As SUVs have multiplied in the United States and beyond, they have fed a highway arms race that has made the world's roads less and less hospitable for car drivers, worsening a trend that hurts safety and the environment alike. Every year that the United States and the world wait to take action, the problems only become worse.
Background Briefing's coordinating producer is Linda McGuinness. Technical operator, Russell Stapleton. Research, Paul Bolger. Our executive producer is Kirsten Garrett. I'm Stephen Skinner, and you're listening to ABC Radio National.